The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Now, stored in West Virginia, the ATF has collected information on more than 54 million gun owners in 2021. And while there is not an official federal database, I have to question what else is more official than a federal agency having the names and other pertinent info of those who have purchased a gun. Now, the Biden administration is preparing to actually suggest a series of regulations for firearms, leading gun rights advocates to worry about an unlawful national database of firearms that could be created.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's a big story, and I just want to bring that to your attention. I'll dive into that coming up here in a second. Also, I want to continue a series. Yesterday, we spoke to The Pillar. They've been doing a series. They've put their finger on the pulse of what's happening across the country regarding Catholic life in the United States, and they looked at everything from how often people go to Mass to, you know, believing in the true presence. Today, they released a report, and this will come up in a few minutes. We'll talk a little later about this, on the impact of COVID-19 on Mass attendance. I have my own theory on it. I've seen the results of the impact, whether or not we'll come back to the numbers we had pre-COVID. That's another thing. I know there are certain dioceses that's still not a requirement to come back, but that's coming up. We'll dive into that a little bit later in the hour. Right now, though, the Second Amendment, let's talk about that for a moment. Constantly under scrutiny in our country, isn't it? A lot of dialogue. People are very passionate about gun ownership in this country. And you're either, you know, doesn't seem to be a whole lot of middle ground. I was going to say you're either on one side or the other. You know, back in June, the president claimed that from the beginning, the Constitution, it limits the type of weapons that you can own. Saying, for example, look, you can't go out and just buy a cannon, right? And the Washington Post, of all places, they called him out on that. They gave him four Pinocchios because, honestly, it's false. We've been following this this Kyle Rittenhouse story, and right now in Kenosha, Wisconsin, a lot of legal experts are saying that, look, this is not a trial over whether or not this kid killed somebody or not. It really is much broader. It's not about one individual. This you know what's on trial right now? The right to self-defense. That's what's on trial. That's what they're saying right now. Part of the argument being used by prosecutors is that this Kyle Rittenhouse, he was 17, he's now 18, I think, when it happened, that his mere presence, standing by a store to protect it from looters, holding an AR-style gun, that was a provocation. And that shooting those that he did in self-defense, that was also a provocation. Provocation, of course, would rule out the use of the self-defense argument there. But there's something else that's going on. Something else that is causing gun owners across the country a lot of alarm. And I don't know whether you own a weapon or not, but I just thought I'd throw this before you. The Washington Free Beacon got hold of some documents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And it showed that since the very beginning of the year, since the start of this year, they've collected records. That organization, that bureau, has collected records on nearly 55 million gun owners. And they did this by getting the records from the gun stores that now have gone out of business. So under the law, stores are required to store the records for 20 years, but the ATF has gathered all of those records, stored them at a facility in West Virginia. And the Biden administration actually, he wants all transactions. He wants all firearms transaction records to go to that facility in order to make a searchable database to know who owns a gun and where they are. A move that the gun rights groups, they've long opposed. So I thought, look, this is worth a conversation. I think we should talk about our Second Amendment. We should talk about self-defense. We should talk about, more than anything else, what looks like a Stasi move, doesn't it? The government wanting a database of who owns weapons. What's next? Joined right now by David Koppel. He's a research director of the Independence Institute in Denver and an associate policy analyst with the Cato Institute in Washington. And he's been with us many times in the past. He wrote a book. It's called The Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. And you can find him a couple places. One, he's got a website, and the way he spells his last name is this. It's Dave, Koppel.org. Dave Koppel, K K-O-P-E-L. His Twitter handle is the same thing, at Dave Koppel. And it's good to have him with us today. Welcome back, Professor. Delighted to talk to you again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, a lot going on here, boy. And in this Rittenhouse trial, a lot of people looking at the issue of self-defense. And then you've got, you know, this issue of a database being created of gun owners. Is the federal government, let's start with that one first, are they allowed to compile records on who owns guns in our country? And maybe you can lay that out. What are some of the basics?
Sure. So the Gun Control Act of 1968 set up the system, which is every time you buy a gun from a licensed retail store, you fill out a federal form, the form 4473, which is a permanent record of a record of that sale. And, you know, you indicate who you are, what your identification is. You swear under penalty of serious felony prosecution that you don't fit various categories of people who are prohibited from having firearms. And it also records the make, model, and serial number of the gun you bought. At the time, President Lyndon Johnson was pushing for a national gun registry. That was his big objective. The Gun Control Act was a compromise where there would be a record on a sale, but the records would not be centralized. They'd be held by the gun stores and available for inspection if appropriate for the investigation of a crime. The regulations under that say that gun dealers have to keep those records for 20 years, and that when they go out of business, they have to send all of their records, or at least all of their records within the last 20 years, to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And that's been going on right from the start. But in the last several years, including under the Obama administration and continuing under the Trump administration, which talked big on the Second Amendment, but was a lot weaker on the action side of things, the ATF takes those forms and scans them into a computer database. And so that's one of the reasons why, you know, if you go to buy a gun in a store and you write down, you have to, like, say, fill out the state, your address. And if you wrote out, say, WISC as your abbreviation for Wisconsin,
right,
the gun dealer will get very upset, because when the ATF inspects his records, they insist that you have to use the two-letter postal code, like WI, because that makes it easier for their scanning machines, ultimately. And the ATF says that when they put these records into this computer database, the database is not searchable by the buyer's name. And let's presume they're telling the truth on that. But even if they are, it ain't that hard to change the software on a database,
right,
so that you can search each field in the database rather than excluding that one particular field. The federal law that applies to this comes from a reform of the Gun Control Act that was enacted in 1986 called the Firearms Owners Protection Act. And I'll read you what that says. It's from 18 United States Code, Section 926A3. Sorry, let me get that for you right there.
That's fine.
So I can read it to you.
My guess,
no rule or regulation. Got it here. No rule or regulation prescribed after the date of the enactment of the Firearms Owners Protection Act, that would be May 19th, 1986, may require that records required to be maintained under this chapter, or any portion of the contents of such records, be recorded at or transferred to a facility owned, managed, or controlled by the United States or any state, or any political subdivision thereof, nor that any system of registration of firearms, firearms owners, or firearms transactions or dispositions be established. Now, even by ATF's, presuming they're telling the truth, they are at least making a registry of firearms, even though you can't search currently the firearms owners. And that's been going on for years. And, you know, this 54 million records that they computerized, it was probably a large year for them because with the COVID pandemic and all the lockdowns and things like that, a lot of small businesses went out of business. So that's a guess for why they might have had so many last year.
And you saw record gun sales. I mean, there were more gun sales in the past 18 months than we've ever seen. We were reporting on it like crazy. People were buying multiple weapons. They were concerned what was going to happen with the election, what was going to happen to the ability to purchase those, et cetera. But to this database, just kind of a thumbnail on that, should citizens be concerned? And what kind of abuse can come from this? And in addition to that, you know, what can ultimately be done?
Well, we know from around the world and from New York City under Mayor Michael Bloomberg that the purpose of registration is confiscation. Yep. So, for example, registration for long guns, rifles and shotguns, was introduced in New York City in 1967. And people said, it was only $2 to register a gun. And the people said, oh, look, we just want to have records on things. We would never use this for confiscation. And until a later New York City Council changed its mind and enacted a law for confiscation of some long guns in 1989, and then enacted and then in the early 2000s enacted another law to confiscate more long guns. So we know that was under the Bloomberg administration. That's why you have the records. The utility of gun registration records for actually finding some criminal who committed a crime is quite low. Usually the people who perpetrate crimes with guns aren't the people who bought them in the gun store. You know, at some point the gun might have been stolen and then it gets into the black market, and so there's no possibility you're going to have a record of that guy who bought it from his you know, second cousin Vinny, who bought it from some guy, who's a professional burglar.
You know, the Second Amendment, Professor, of course, doesn't restrict what kind of weapons you can own. Yet the government seems to be constantly trying to come up with that definition or trying to do that. Do you think we're going to come to a time where we're going to see that? And correct me if I'm wrong on that premise there. What do you see happening, and would it be okay if they did say, okay, you can buy guns, but you can't have these semi-automatic weapons, or you can't buy the bazooka or whatever it is that you want to get?
Well, so the Supreme Court's decision in District of Columbia versus Heller, which affirmed that the Second Amendment is a normal individual right, and therefore D.C. couldn't ban people from possessing handguns. The court there said that, you know, looking at the history and tradition, that it was okay to ban dangerous and unusual weapons. Mm-hmm. And the way the court looked at that, that would include short-barrel shotguns, which had been the subject of a 1939 Supreme Court case, United States versus Miller, and also machine guns. And that would probably, by extension, that also covers bazookas and grenades and atomic weapons and things like that.
It makes sense. So, you know, I think the argument from the other side is that, look, the ordinary citizen doesn't need a semi-automatic weapon. Why do you need these type of weapons? Why would you need a machine gun today? How do you respond to those who say, you know, it would be a good thing to have some more control and to have some limits over these, get some of the guns off the streets? What's your argument against that?
Well, sure. And then that's the law we've had for machine guns ever since the National Firearms Act of 1934. You need to pay a $200 tax and go through a long registration process with the federal government. And you can't even buy a machine gun that was manufactured after 1986. Right. So we've got very strict controls on machine guns, and the Supreme Court has said, you know, that's machine guns are not really a Second Amendment issue. What the gun confiscation lobby has been very effective at doing is misleading people about guns that to somebody who doesn't know anything about guns, look like a machine gun, but are not. Mm-hmm. So when you say a gun is semi-automatic, you're talking about a operational system that was invented in 1885 and has been common in American firearms since at least the 1890s. Right. With a semi-automatic, if you press the trigger once, one bullet comes out. With an automatic, like a machine gun, if you press the trigger and hold it down, ammunition will fire continuously. Right. So a machine gun, a real automatic, fires at least four times as fast as a semi-automatic does, the one bullet at a time type. So that's the difference. But the confiscation folks have confused a lot of people into thinking that when they see a gun that, you know, that does have a futuristic or military type look to it, oh, that must be a machine gun. But it's not at all. So the most popular rifle in American history is the AR-15 type, and those are regular, first introduced in the American market in 1964. They're regular one bullet at a time guns, just like every other normal gun.
Wow. You know, there's a case going on right now that I'd love your take on, and it's that Kyle Rittenhouse trial. A lot of videos, so you can see the multiple angles. There's lots of testimonies. And there are people saying, look, right now what we're seeing is this right to self-defense on trial. Will that right to self-defense survive the Kyle Rittenhouse trial? And what do you make of the argument that's now being used?
Well, I think it'll survive because based on unless the jurors get intimidated by the criminals who are trying to threaten them. You know, there was somebody who was photographing them a few days ago as they were entering the court. And that obviously was an implied threat that if there is an acquittal, not only is Kenosha going to burn again, but we're going to come and kill you people personally. So that, you know, that can have an understandable effect on a juror's mind. But if the jurors just stick with the evidence, it's a very easy case for self-defense on the part of Kyle Rittenhouse. One of the criminals who was a convicted pedophile with severe mental problems, who had threatened that earlier that evening, specifically to kill Rittenhouse if he could get him alone. Right. And then when he got Rittenhouse alone, he lunged towards Rittenhouse and tried to take his rifle away and grab the muzzle, and that's when Rittenhouse shot him at the last possible second. Another guy who got shot was also trying to kill Rittenhouse as Rittenhouse was on the ground. The guy was beating him on the head with a skateboard. Yeah. And then the third guy who was injured but survived was shot when he pointed his own handgun straight at Rittenhouse. So, this is not a difficult case for self-defense, and it really shows how politicized and lawless the local prosecutor's office is that they even brought charges.
Yeah. We'll find out what happens Monday, of course, is of course, the jury went home this weekend, and they'll reconvene on Monday. I only have a few moments left for you, and I do want to talk about, I was just thinking as we were going through the type of weapons we can have. You know, technology is an amazing thing. It's always evolving. I saw recently somebody took Boston Scientific dog robot. I don't know if you're familiar with that. They attached a gun to it, right? How does the law look at that? I mean, how does that get regulated? And should that be regulated? Because now you've got a gun attached to something else that is robotic. You know, your thoughts on that?
I think what people are, at least some people are saying in the context of using these in a military autonomous systems like robots in a military context is it should be allowed only when the decision to shoot has to be made by a human. Yeah. That the robot dog or whatever can't decide on its own. Yeah. And I think a rule like that is would be completely appropriate in a domestic kind of context. You can't create something that can go off and shoot a human being without a human being who makes the personal responsibility, takes the personal responsibility for ensuring that that action, that profound action, is in full compliance with the law.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of a frightening prospect, though, of what looms for the future with miniature drones and with artificial intelligence and swarms and things along those lines. A lot to think about. Hey, your book, if anybody wants to check it out or follow you, the best way to do that is just your website, davekopel.org. What's the best way to connect?
Exactly. There's that, and you can buy the book, The Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action, The Judeo-Christian Tradition. You can buy that at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever. And if your local bookstore doesn't have it, which they might not, they would be happy to special order for you and could have it for you in a few days, and you can support a local bookstore.
I love it. Hey, Professor, I look forward to our next conversation. I'm sure it won't be long. There's a lot to talk about, and we'll see what happens with self-defense and Rittenhouse next week. But thank you for giving me some of your Friday. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and have a good Sunday as well.
You too. That's David Kopel. And the book, The Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action, a lot to look at, from the government creating databases to, of course, this issue of self-defense. And just one final thought on the whole issue of self-defense. You know, somebody breaks into your home and they threaten you and your family with physical harm. How are you, as a Christian, supposed to respond? Should you turn the other cheek, let them do it? You kill your children, your wife? Who knows, right? Should you defend yourself and your family? For most people, it's a no-brainer. I mean, there are some people who, and I spoke to a priest once, several of them, who would not do anything. But we do have a right to legitimate self-defense. We have a right to defend our family in our home when we're violated. And the church calls that legitimate defense. It's part of the catechism. And as I said yesterday, get the book. If you don't have a catechism, it goes right on the shelf next to your Bible. And those two things go hand in hand. Catechism number 2264 says that love towards oneself remains a fundamental principle of morality. Therefore, it is legitimate to insist on respect for one's own right to life. Somebody who defends his life is not guilty of murder, even if he is forced to deal his aggressor a lethal blow. And some are saying that's what happened with Kyle Rittenhouse. You might be confronted by this at some point in your own future. There's another paragraph there I was reading earlier today, and I will share it with you, and I'll leave you with this thought. Paragraph number 2265. Legitimate defense can be not only a right, but listen to this, a grave duty for one who is responsible for the lives of others. He says, the defense of the common good requires that an unjust aggressor be rendered unable to cause harm. For this reason, those who legitimately hold authority also have the right to use arms to repel aggressors against the civil community entrusted to their responsibility. So if somebody breaks in your home at night and threatens your family, catechism says you do have the right to do that. I hope I never have to face that, and I'd rather lay my life down than take somebody's life. But that is something to think about. The church has very clear teaching on all of that. You know, Jesus commanded in Matthew's gospel to not resist one who is evil, to turn the other cheek. I think that is also a good commandment to follow if we can, right? To go the extra mile, with somebody, to give them their cloak. But when your family's life or your life is in jeopardy, you do have a right to legitimate self-defense. We'll probably talk more about this next week. You know, I'm sure the trial will have a verdict, and I think it might be good to unpack this teaching of the church. Stay with me, though, because when we come back, another great conversation is about to unfold. COVID and the impact on Mass. Are you going back to Mass? Have you been back? What's it like in your church? Is it just as full? Is it half full? What are you seeing? If you're not back to church, why not? All right, when we come back, I'll give you the latest from the pillar. I love the fact they've been diving into this. I think this is revealing. I'll be joined once again by Brian Hodge, and he's the one who's been doing, he's responsible for the study. I'll give you the latest, give you a snapshot of what's happening with the church here in America.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Connect with Drew on the Relevant Radio app.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's Anderson East. This too shall last. Good to be with you. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for being part of the Relevant Radio family. It's so good to be able to, navigate life, to take a look at everything from, you know, some of the very fundamental principles that the church teaches regarding legitimate defense to COVID to the power of prayer. I mean, you look at just some of the different things that we've taken a look at today. We dealt with student loan debt. I want to look at the faith. I want to look at the Mass. I don't know if you're going to Mass this Sunday or not. When was the last time you've been there? Maybe you're tuned in and say, I don't need to go. You know, I believe in God. I don't need organized religion. God's good. He's merciful. He understands me. Maybe you're in that camp. Maybe you are a regular Mass goer. Maybe during COVID, you kind of get out of the habit of it. I thought we'd talk about this. I think it was last week. I had a guy on the air. He was responsible for, a study that's being done by The Pillar. And this is a great study. And you can check out pillarcatholic.com. That's their website. His name was Brendan Hodge. And you know, we looked at the state of Catholics in America today. And over the course of the week, they've been revealing the data that they found. And they undertook a major, major study on religious affiliation and belief. And what they found is some fascinating data and some great results. If you missed my conversation, I think it was last Wednesday, or this past Wednesday, I should say, just go to relevantradio.com. You can go to my archives, my podcasts, and just look for that conversation. It's well worth listening to, trust me. Plus, I think I shared on that day what His Excellency Archbishop Gomez had to say about the new religion that we're seeing in our country. Great, great conversations. So share them with others as well. Today was a big day. They took a look at COVID's impact on the Mass. And it's obvious that COVID has had seriously impacted the entire life of the country. I mean, yeah, I think you see that in everything from the businesses that have closed to the houses of worship. Last year's shutdown forced it forced everybody really to stay at home. Right? You couldn't even go to Mass. My heart broke for people who lost loved ones and they couldn't even bury them. I know a lot of marriages were postponed. And it doesn't take a genius to figure out that when you shut the doors to a place, it's going to have an impact on future attendance. Right? It happens all the time with restaurants. You're closed for a while. Suddenly people start going somewhere else. Happens in radio or television. You know, if you're not on the air for a while, people will go somewhere else. So the same thing is happening now in the church. Last week, the folks at The Pillar released this extensive survey of Catholic life in the United States. One of the aspects of this is, well, how often people go to Mass. And the result, to you, it might be surprising. Before COVID, I'll just give you some of the numbers. 41% of Catholics, they said they went to Mass weekly. First of all, can I just stop on that point for a minute? 41% of Catholics said they went to weekly Mass. 41%? 4 out of 10 Catholics? Really? What about the other 60%, right? The other 59%? The other 6 out of 10? More Catholics are staying home than going to Mass? No wonder there is a crisis in our schools. No wonder our kids are confused. No wonder we're seeing cohabitation and contraception and abortion and all the redefinition of marriage. Of course. You know, when you stray from the sacraments, when you don't know your faith, there's a ripple effect to it. And I'm delighted our bishops are going to be underway with a very beautiful campaign to revitalize the Eucharist. I think it's going to change things. I really do. I think the future is a bright one for the church in America. And I've been saying that for a while. And we'll see how that all plays out. But I'm pretty sure that's the case. But 41% of Catholics went to Mass weekly. Okay, that was before COVID-19. So guess what they found? What's the amount that say they go to mass? Now, the same amount said they went to mass anywhere between a few times a month and less than once annually. 18% said they never went. So those numbers, they've changed drastically. They really have. 36% go weekly. 35% go a few times a month and less than once annually. 29% say they never go, not even watch mass on live stream. And that's an 11% jump in just 1 year. I know that's a lot of numbers. I'm going to bring Brendan on. He can probably re-articulate in a way that's maybe a little bit more understandable. But there are other impacts as well, like how often people go to confession. And I've been talking about this too. If people aren't going to mass, let me tell you one thing. They're certainly not going to confession. Confession requires a lot of humility, doesn't it? And it's a one sacrament that Satan does not want you to go to because it frees you from his hooks. It frees you. So be very curious to see what those numbers are. And they looked also at how people are participating in parish life. So we're going to continue to follow what they find. I hope you'll follow them too at the Pillar. I think it's well worth the read. PillarCatholic.org is their website. And I've invited back once again, Brendan Hodge. Good to have you with us. Thanks for your hard work on that study. And welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about the pandemic. I think, you know, like I said, it doesn't take a genius to see what was going to happen. When the lockdown started, people knew that when, they were able to go back to mass. I mean, it was, I would assume everybody knew that attendance would be down, but I guess the surprise for me, did anyone know it was going to be as dramatic, as drastic, as bad as this? Maybe you can rearticulate those numbers in a way that's easy to comprehend visually and give me your take on that. Because as I said last time you were on, when you get out of the habit of going to mass, it's very easy to stay out of that habit, to form a new habit, and one that keeps you from going to mass. But your thoughts, Brendan?
Yeah, I certainly was surprised by the results. I thought that we might see slightly lower attendance, but I was surprised at how big the effect was. I think maybe a good way to think about what happened is if you think about 100 people who used to go to mass weekly, out of those 100, 75 are still going to mass weekly. 17 are now going only sometimes, and 8 are not going at all.
Wow.
So that's a big drop off, but there is a little bit of good news that comes in too. So out of the people who were going less frequently, 10% of people who are going less frequently are now going weekly. So you have a little bit of those, and even a few people who used to say that they never went to mass are now going to mass. 2% of people who said they were never going to mass are now going to mass. So clearly some people may be shaken a little bit out of their out of their status quo. But overall, you kind of put all the numbers together, and if a priest used to see 100 people out there in the congregation, now he's only seeing 86. So it's definitely gone down.
So, and I understand why people stopped attending. We had a pandemic. There was health concerns. That was a major issue. Now that the doors, in theory, are reopened, what's keeping people out? Is it just laziness? Did they figure out, God's not going to strike me with a lightning bolt, Or, hey, I can watch it on the internet. I don't have to get dressed, What's the rationale? I don't know if you found that out. What's keeping people from returning?
So we didn't have a question about sort of why have you not come back. But I think, as you pointed out, when we talked last time, when we asked people who'd been away from the church for a year or more at some point in their lives, why did you stop going? It was shocking to me how prosaic a lot of the reasons were. People said things like, my work schedule changed, or I moved. And so I think for a lot of people, going to mass is just kind of a habit. And if they hear the right words and they have the right experiences, that can become something deeper and they can develop a really deep attachment to it. But for a lot of people, it is just kind of a habit. And you know how it is. I mean, if you have a habit of, going to the gym on the way home from work and you change jobs and so it's no longer on your route, suddenly you're not working out anymore. And I think for a lot of people, it's kind of at that level that they don't have that deeper attachment. And so when something throws them off, it's hard for them to get back into it.
Yeah, I agree. You did some analysis on people who are missing. Tell us a little bit about them.
people who are missing in terms of sort of what are the profile of people who have stopped coming to Mass?
Right.
So one of the things that we found is that if you look at kind of other Catholic practices, you can kind of see that it's the people who were most most involved in Catholic devotions and other aspects of Catholicism in their lives who were most likely to keep going to Mass. So one of the things that we did is we looked at how often people say they go to confession. And if you look at people who say that they go to confession at least once a month, of those people, 84% of them are still going to weekly Mass. Whereas if you look at the people who say they never go to confession, it's only 56% who still say that they're going to weekly Mass. So I think even among the people who were making the effort to go to weekly Mass, if you think about sort of how deeply Catholicism had penetrated their lives and how important it was to them, it's the people who are a little bit more out there on the margins who, when they had a break, didn't have that deep attachment to draw them back.
Brendan, I'm curious, though, as to the demographics of who is missing or who's not coming back to church. I'm assuming it's not the elderly. Is there an age, you know, is it male? Is it female? Is it old? Is it young? I mean, who is it decided not to come? Is it young parents? I mean, who's not returning?
So it was pretty well spread across, because I was wondering, is it, you know, we tell people, hey, you're not safe if you're older, so you should be staying home because you might get COVID, or, you know, are the people who are worried about their kids? But really, it was pretty well across the board. The average age of Catholics who are attending, still attending Mass is 46. And if we look at the people who were going before COVID, it was 50. So we lost a little bit more on the older edge, but it's honestly pretty close. Only 19% of those who stopped going to church are 65 or older. So it's really pretty across the board.
Let's take a few phone calls for you, too. You know, time goes so quickly here. If you want to get in, I'll open the phones. We've got a few moments. I'd love to hear your experience, or feel free to share your perspective or ask your questions. The number's 888-914-9149. We'll go to Atwater, California. Linda, good afternoon. You're on the air with Brendan Hodge.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a lot of family members that don't believe that anyone's going to go to hell except for Stalin and Hitler. Everyone else is going to be saved. That's one of the things they believe. And they're very afraid to go to church because they feel that if they go to church, they're going to get COVID, but yet they go everywhere else and they're fine going everywhere else but church. And these family members don't believe in birth control. I believe that birth control should be usable. The Catholic Church should get, you know, into the modern times and start being able to allow that. They believe that a woman has the right to choose. And again, that they themselves would not have an abortion, but every woman should have the ability to choose. And that it shouldn't be a sin. And it really is very discouraging as a conservative Catholic.
Well, you know, next week, Linda, I'm going to be doing a show on the reality of hell. Monsignor Pope's going to be stopping by. Wrote a great article on it. So you might want to pass that along to them after it airs, or have them tune in. But let's talk about your point, because, you know, you're talking about a family or a person that is representative of a lot of people in this country. And Brendan, to her point, there are a lot of people who don't believe in hell. There are a lot of people who say, hey, I don't believe in abortion, but it's not my right. It's not my body. It's up to the woman. You go through all these things that you just heard Linda articulate. To me, what it says, and this is my own perspective, that we have a crisis of catechesis, that people don't know their faith. They're not well-formed in morality or their theology. Therefore, these issues get muddied. What are you finding? I mean, because if you don't know your faith, you're not going to live it. You know, if you don't believe Jesus is present in the Eucharist, you're not going to go to Mass. As you begin to drill into this data with your study, how big of a demographic is that person she just described? And what is one of the main factors, or what are the factors that help people to kind of come up with that type of rationalization?
So you're right. It is a very big demographic. One of the things that got the bishops going on their plans to draft a document on the Eucharist and try to have a Eucharistic revival and try to build new devotion to the Eucharist was this Pew Research finding from a couple of years ago, where they asked Catholics if they believed in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And only about 60% of Catholics who go to church said that they believed in the real presence. And we got very similar results. So we had a question in there where we asked, do you believe that the Eucharist is the body and blood of Christ? And it was, you know, it was a list of other beliefs that we asked people about, and only 50% of weekly mass goers check that box. So we have a lot of people who do not believe that. And I think you're right about catechesis, because one of the things that we did is we broke that down by age. And if you look at, say, Catholics that were born in the 1940s, people who probably used the Baltimore Catechism, 91% of them said that they believe that the Eucharist is the body and blood of Christ. That's about 70% for people born in the 50s and 60s. But when you get down to people born in the 1990s, it's 25%. And that's 25% of people who are going to Mass.
Wow. That's stunning. Amazing. I got to hold it right here, Brendan. We're going to come back. We'll take a few more calls and we can talk more. If you want to get in, I'm approaching the final minutes of my time with you today. The number here is 888-914-9149. Taking a look at the state of Catholics in America today, a very in-depth study. And in particular, COVID's impact on the Mass. Feel free to join us. Love to hear from you. Our conversation continues with more right after this. Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, I am traveling to the Holy Land in February with our underwriting sponsor, Nativity Pilgrimage. Information is available at relevantradio.com/Holy Land. That's relevantradio.com/Holy Land. Well, as you're joining me, if you're just getting plugged in, taking a look at COVID, the effect on the Mass, a new report from the Pillar indicates that the number of Catholics who say they go to Mass every week has dropped. So the pews, yes, they are a-changing. And I'm joined today by the man who helped spearhead that study, Brendan Hodge. Brendan, it's good to have you back with us here. People want to read this report, by the way, or all the reports that are now coming. I know you've been releasing the series. What's the best way to get connected?
Yeah, so they should go to pillarcatholic.com. And it is a Substack site, which means you can subscribe to it. It is a free subscription that you can also support the site. So if you want to get our emails every week, you can put your email into the subscription box there and you'll get updates in your email box every week.
I do that. I get it every week. We love what you do there. And I appreciate the good work that Ed Condon and J.D. Flynn and you are doing. Let's jump back in the phones because time's my enemy. I only have a few minutes left and a lot of people want to join the conversation. Marie is tuned in San Diego, California, and she wants to share. Hi, Marie.
Hi. You know, I am a family. I'm from a family of 10 kids. Now, I am probably the only one who, no, maybe there's one other one, but I'm the only Orthodox Catholic left, and I just can't believe among all my brothers and sisters, we were raised by the same parents. You know, we grew up in the same household, and they don't believe in the real presence. They don't believe that they need to go to confession. They don't believe that they have to go to church. They don't believe in heaven and hell. And, you know, one of my brothers said to me, you know, you need just to give up that religion thing. And I'm just flabbergasted, right? But I also think back to, you know, I listen to Relevant Radio all the time, and they don't, you know, I'm much more catechized because of it. But I heard once that faith is a gift. I heard this on Relevant Radio, I'm sure of it, that faith is a gift. And I just thought, well, you know, why is it that God, you know, opens some people's hearts more, you know, because I know he's opened my heart to all of this because I strayed for a little while. It's just frustrating. And it makes me sad for my brothers and sisters.
Well, two things, Marie. One, pray for them. All right. Because there's not a family around, mine included, that does not need conversion. And we need to pray for our siblings or our children or our loved ones. And then two, have hope. Okay. And I mean that because I really do believe things are going to change. I'm glad the Pillar's doing these reports. I'm glad we're looking at the state of the church right now. You know, when it came to the priestly abuse scandal, you look back at what happened in 2001 and what subsequently followed. There's new reports out where that rate of abuse, all of those things statistically have changed so radically. Right now, you look at the lack of true presence in the Eucharist or people believing the true presence and pews emptying. I believe that's all going to change. I think the couple years ahead, Relevant Radio plays a role in it. The Pillar plays a role in it. Everyone who's evangelizing is part of this effort. But I do think the bishops have their fingers on one of the heart of the matter, and that really is this revitalization for the Eucharist. I think attitudes will soon change. I think grace is going to flow. But Brendan, I'll let you respond to her as well. She shares the frustration of millions of Catholics across the country, probably around the world.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly common experience too. I mean, I look at my extended family, and most of my aunts and uncles, most of my cousins are no longer Catholic, or will kind of say they're Catholic, but don't actually go to church frequently. And I think that's one of the things that we saw with our study too, is that, I mean, out of people who were raised Catholic, only about 70% still call themselves Catholic. And then out of those 70% who still call themselves Catholic, less than half actually go to Mass. And then as we see in some of the responses people have about belief in the real presence, even those who go to Mass often really have a long way to go in terms of deepening their faith and understanding why it's important.
Well, thank you for your call. We do appreciate it. Move along, take another quick call here. Is it Nancy who's up next, guys? Or Renee? Who are we going to? Nancy, listening in New Jersey. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. It's a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thanks.
I'm likewise. Calling, you know, about the topic, and I'm as I'm listening to everything, I'm thinking about when 9/11 occurred. Mm-hmm. People were flocking to their churches. They yeah. wanted the churches open, and I remember just when that happened, because I live in the, you know, New York City metropolitan area, and people were just they were in the churches and for a good 2-3 weeks. And it's so sad because the way I see it is we have so much materialism and what you see going on in, on television, and everything we have is such a distraction. If we let it become a distraction, you know, young students, like the young kids now, they have sports on Sundays and Saturdays. And I feel that all these things have whittled down, you know, church attendance, and it's really sad. I even see in my own church that in spite of the fact that our church actually has a monetary surplus, we're not seeing the people back in church the way they should be. You know, maybe a third of who, you know, who attended church initially, you know, so. Just thought I'd share that.
Well, no, thank you. And I share your concerns, and I'll let Brendan, I'll let you respond too. But I can vividly remember 9/11 when that took place. And she's so right. I remember going to my church that Sunday, going to normal time, and I couldn't even get in the parking lot. You know, I had to park somewhere way down the street in order to just get into my local church. Last time I saw that filled was probably Christmas, when everybody comes out and you can barely get in. And it's funny how things do change. You know, when crisis strikes, sometimes people turn back to God. When people get too soft, comfortable, too apathetic, they don't think they need God, and the church is kind of empty. I'll let you respond. Your thoughts. You said more than that, but I'll give you the floor because I have a couple moments left.
Yeah, so I would agree. It seems like there has been a serious effect on the number of people going to Mass, and I think it's got to be partly that people were forced to stay away from Mass during that key time when they were seeking for solace. What I think back to is in that point there in middle of March where things were starting to shut down, but we hadn't yet had a ruling from our bishop. I live in Ohio, and we went to Mass, and the priest at the end of Mass said, as we face this pandemic that's coming in front of us, I think that what we all need is deeper prayer. And so instead of giving a final hymn, we're going to be putting the Eucharist on the altar, and we're going to have adoration for 10 minutes so that everyone can pray for everyone in the pandemic. And I thought that was such an incredibly moving thing. It was really important to us. And And then before that next Sunday, we had the announcement that things were locking down for the next several weeks. So wow. I think it was a tough time that affected a lot of people.
It really was. Well, Brendan, I want to thank you for your time. I only have about a minute left. My apologies to everyone on hold. Would love to get it. And Renee in Wisconsin, I wish I could have gotten her on. She says, you know, the bishops closed the churches, and they're saying that it's not important. I didn't have a chance to get Renee on, so I don't know all of her comment. But my thought is a lot of the bishops shut the doors, not because they didn't think it was important. I think they did that out of safety for their flock. And in terms of the bishops shutting doors, I'm assuming that was the rationale for this, right, Brendan?
Yeah, exactly, because there was a lot of concern about spread and the number of cases going up. And one of the things that we did get is we asked people, did they feel like their church had done enough to keep people safe? And the responses were very high on that. So people did seem to think that their churches had watched out for them in that sense.
Yeah, I'll re-echo that. I mean, the churches, the plural, I went to a number of different churches. I mean, the protocols they put in place were excellent, and you did feel safe. Hey, Brendan, thank you. We'll continue to follow your great work. Keep it up, okay? We'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
And my thanks. Thank you for allowing me to give you a look at the faith, give you a look at life. You know, spend part of my afternoon with you. I'll be back again on Monday. Kyle Clark is coming up. Father Rocky will pray the rosary at 7. Until next week, remember God loves you. So do I. Have a great day.